We have a quorum. I called the meeting to order for the State Government Finance Committee. Representative Detmer, get you, now that we've got it in our possession and we will get this out of the way and move it along. We heard this yesterday, so I don't know how much testimony we have to have on the bill. I'll move House File 1773 to be laid over for possible inclusion. And we have an amendment, the 17.
That's right, Mr. Chair, A2 amendment.
The A2 amendment, correct. And I'll move the amendment. I just want to briefly describe the amendment. And then,
Mr. Chair and members, basically, when we looked at the bill, there's supposed to be matching funds with this. So that's what the A2 amendment does. The transfer is not available until the Commissioner of Management and Budget determines the equal amount of commitment from non-state sources. So the Medal of Honor Committee, they've been, for the past 3 years, they've been raising funds for this project. I know we also were, Minnesota was the host of the Medal of Honor National Convention. I got to meet 44 Medal of Honor recipients. Just incredible, just to hear their stories. And Minnesota's had 72 Medal of Honor recipients over the years, dating back to the Civil War. So if you know the Capitol grounds, there's that fountain over there by the Veterans Building that hasn't worked for several years because it was leaking and so forth. That's going to be the location of the Medal of Honor recipient, and it's going to have an educational for schools, educational component, so it's going to be, I think, a neat thing for the Capitol grounds, and I appreciate getting this before your committee, Mr. Chair.
Well, thank you. So all in questions about the amendment? If not, all in favor of the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment's adopted. And
I think, Mr. Chair, you've heard all the testimony before. Appreciate it that we had that informational hearing yesterday, and I didn't have to bring my testifiers back, but I really appreciate it. And I think it's going to be a really valuable asset to our Capitol grounds to have this Medal of Honor memorial there.
So with that, members, I'll lay 1773 over. Is there anybody from the audience that wants to speak on this bill? Seeing nobody rushing to the podium, I'll lay this bill over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
As amended.
Next, we'll get the Representative Hewitt. If you had a chance to look at the minutes.
I have, Mr. Chair, and I so move.
Representative Hewitt moves the minutes, the approval of the minutes for March 27th. 2019. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Well, 2 minutes are approved. And the next thing on our agenda is the governor's recommendation for the contribution to the public pensions for the state or the city of Minneapolis. And Mr. Ranieri and Mr. Representative Long, welcome to the committee. And reason Representative Long is at the table is because he has a bill that we don't have in our possession to do this. So, Representative Long, you want to describe what we're doing here? And
thank you so much, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This is a straightforward issue of upholding an agreement between local governments in Minneapolis and the state regarding a closed pension plan. The plan was closed in 1979. There's been a long history of state contributions to this plan. In fact, state contributions have been made towards this pension fund since it was closed in 1979. In 2010, there was a law that consolidated the pension plan, MERF, into PIRA. There was a $55 million total contribution to the pension plan at that time, and the agreement under the law in 2010 was that 44% of the contribution would be paid for by the state and 56% would be paid for by the employers, so a $24 million contribution by the state and a $31 million contribution by the employers. In 2015, The fund exceeded the 80% funding ratio, which triggered the ability to merge the fund into PIRA. And so there was a merger agreement in 2015 that was accompanied by a new actuarial evaluation of the fund. And the contribution, annual contribution, was reduced from $55 million a year to $37 million a year. The state absorbed this as part of the agreement. The state was to absorb the savings for the first 2 years, but it was always part of the agreement that for years beyond those first 2 years, it would go back to parity of the same allocation that had been the contribution between the state and the employer since 2010. And that would be the state paying $16 million a year, or 43%, and the employer is paying $21 million a year, or 57%. And this was the case for the payments that were made in 2017 and in 2018. However, last year the state payments were reduced for 2019 through 2031 to $6 million, with the rest being picked up by the employers. The $6 million for the state would mean that employers would now be picking up 82% of the cost, much higher than the 57% that has been paid for six of the last 8 years, and not consistent with the agreement that was made in 2010 or in 2015. If the arrangement for 2020 and 2021 goes forward, this would harm local governments whose budgets are already stretched. It would result in $10 million in additional costs, $5.5 million for Minneapolis, $2.3 million for the Minneapolis School Board, $1 million for the Minneapolis Park Board, to name a few. The city, the park board, the school board, all have been budgeting based on this agreement from 2015, and understandably so. They would need to increase property taxes to fill this budget hole if the agreement was not returned to. This is in the governor's budget. We appreciate the governor's support. My bill was in before the Pensions Commission on Tuesday. It passed through without objection, and I respectfully ask the committee to keep faith with the original 2015 agreement, and would turn to Mr. Ranieri for further comments.
Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Gene Ranieri. I'm the Director of Government Relations for the City of Minneapolis. Representative Long did a very good job of summarizing. I want to add a few things. MRF is really a misnomer. The Minneapolis Employee Retirement Fund not only includes the park board, the city, the school board, and its members of the school board who are not teachers, but non-education, non-teachers. Also, there were some workers who worked in our, way back when the city of Minneapolis actually was responsible for wastewater. All cities were responsible for wastewater. With the merger back in 1969, many of our workers went to the Met Council, and at one time the Met Council also was paying into MRF. And another time, Minsky was paying into MRF because there were some teachers at Minneapolis Vocational Tech that were somehow related to the state. In addition, there are some folks at the Airport Commission that are also paying in because they had employees transfer to the MAC several years ago. The city has and continued from 1980 contributing to MRF. The city had issued a levy every year. I have not been able to go back all the way to 1980, but I was able to go back to 1997 to try and calculate how much money has the city and its other employers have contributed to MRF. From 1997 to 2019, the city of Minneapolis has contributed through its levy and other general funds around $207 million. In addition to that, it has added $61 million in bonding. Back in 2002 and 2003, the funds were short over the concerns of former legislator Phyllis Kahn. We did issue bonds in 2002 and 2003 to the amount of $61 million. So that brings us up to about $268 million in contributions from just the city and the park board alone. From 2013 to 2019, I do know that of that $31 million, the local contribution, around 40% came from the other employers. That's about another $80 million. So to date, we have contributed, meaning the employers and the city, around $340 million to the fund. And that's a little bit less than what the state has contributed, but it's within the range of almost being close to 50-50. The funds are closed, so we have maybe one person left in MRF. And the fund, if we are able to do this, we will close in 2031. And originally it was to be 2020, but we just couldn't make that. So the legislation in 2010 passed and made MRF and administratively under the control of PERA. So these dollars do not come to the city or the other employers. They go directly to PERA. Mr. Chairman, I'll stand for any questions.
And Mr. Ranieri, the MRF pension, is that, do the people that collect that pension, do they collect Social Security, or is this their only form of retirement income?
Mr. Chairman, this is their only form of retirement income. They did not receive Social Security. It is not coordinated.
Thank you. And questions? Mr. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And how many cities in the state of Minnesota have the state contributing towards their employee retirement funds?
Mr. Ranieri.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Quam, I'm not sure about cities because most members of city employment belong to PERA, but many of the old police and fire retirement funds, relief funds, many of them merged into PERA police and fire, and there was some state assistance, and there still continue to be state assistance. Also, the state, I think the tax committee this year is considering an extension of a sunset that dealt with state aid being paid to cities for PERA. So there's that money. It's not I don't know the exact number. I think it's about $13 million a year. And it's distributed to cities and counties and also school districts when they merged into PERA to state funds.
TRA.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. They also receive state funding. So there is state funding across the board in many of the pension funds that not only are MRF.
Representative Quam.
Thank you. So that $13 million is annually, and the state contribution to Minneapolis just by itself is how much?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Ranieri.
Do you mean of the $13 million in PERA or the MRF?
Mr. Chair, I'll make it very simple. You said $13 million going to the other cities. How much does Minneapolis by itself in what we're talking about right here today, if the $10 million was added, what would be the total annual contribution from the state just to Minneapolis's retired employees?
Mr. Ranieri.
Mr. Chairman, it would be the state contribution for this program would be $16 million. We would contribute, the employers would contribute $21 million. If this does not happen, the state's contribution would be 6, the employers would be 31, and we are probably around 60% of that 31 or 18.2.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noticed Mr. Rice from the Parks and Rec isn't here.
Yeah, he is.
Yes, he is.
Oh, he is. is my understanding of the current situation that Minneapolis Parks and Recs receives, is it 16 or 17% of the LGA that's given to Minneapolis?
Oh.
Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chair.
Identify yourself for the tape, please.
Yeah, Brian Rice, representing the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board. Mr. Chair, Representative Quam. The Park Board receives 11.79% of the city's LGA.
Okay. And
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doing the math in the head, that's roughly $22 to $25 million. Is that correct,
Mr. Rice?
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam. I believe Minneapolis receives approximately $80 million in LGA a year, so it's, I'd say, more like $9 million a year.
I stand corrected.
So
it's $9 million a year. I was thinking of the per capita is around $220 per capita in LGA. And so I guess what I'm trying to understand is what makes Minneapolis special that they're singled out like this? Because I know there's also singled out when the teachers retired. That fund got rolled in, there's been around the same magnitude of funds going in to support it. I know Duluth is similar to that, but I know most cities in the state, in fact, you know, one of the cities of the first class, you know, doesn't have, you know, anywhere comparable per capita or relational. Was there something historically that happened that made Minneapolis special?
Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chair, Representative Quam, I think there is. I mean, MRF, the MRF fund we're talking about today was created 100 years ago, 1919. That was before Social Security, before PRA existed, and it was not, it has the name Minneapolis, and I know Minneapolis, our city gets controversial around here, but at that time, when it was created, Minneapolis represented 25% of the population of the entire state, up till 1950, when there were 521,000 people. Out of a population of 3 million, Minneapolis was 16% of the population. Why is that important? It's really not the Minneapolis Employees Plan. It was Minneapolis, Hennepin County, the hospital, the jail for the county, the Metropolitan Sewer Commission was built out of the Minneapolis system, the airport. The Metropolitan Airports Commission was actually on Minneapolis Park Board land in 1920s when it was built. And so, like government or not, that pension fund of MRF was the employer of record for the whole network that evolved into basically the Metropolitan Council and that system. And if you're going to have employees, you need to pay them. And there are a lot of legacy costs to these plans. The school district was also had their general employees in the plan, much like the plans that other you know, school districts around the state, they have TRA for teachers and PRA for their other working employees. And so there was this legacy cost system, and it predated Social Security. In the police and fire funds that Mr. Ranieri referenced, those go back to the 1870s. St. Paul had them. Rochester had a police and fire department that wound up getting state aid to consolidate into the plans. I think there were 47 relief associations in like 29 cities. Every one of those 29 cities got aid, because when we set up these pension plans years ago, the actuarial science wasn't very good, the fiscal budgeting wasn't very good, and promises were made, and I think the legislature was really involved in setting up all these systems, and promises were made, and I think the legislature has been pretty good at trying to keep those promises.
And Mr. Rice, who sets the amount that gets paid into these plans, and the amount, the payouts in these plans, the rates of the payout, who sets those?
Mr. Chairman, the Minnesota State Legislature.
And Mr. Rice, what happened in 1979 with these other plans that when PARA was created?
In 79, Mr. Chair, the legislature closed MRF to new employees, essentially terminated the flow of the plan, and when you terminate a pension plan, you create a massive liability that needs to get paid by someone, and since there aren't any new employees, it's the government. Or don't pay the employees. And I think that was, Mr. Chair, that was the situation in 2010 when MRF came to the legislature. There was literally, may have missed this testimony, there was literally only enough for 3 to 5 years of payments to about 5,000 or 6,000 retirees. We'd gone through the Great Recession. There were some bad decisions made locally, but also the state's oversight, you know, didn't set the right contribution levels, and I think everyone agreed it was a real critical situation for these retirees that lived all throughout the state. They're not just Minneapolis residents, nor were they just Minneapolis employees.
Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure why we got into the police because the fire, because I didn't think they were part of this MRF fund. And I was trying to understand why the part that was in MRF fund was different. And thank you for enlightening that there wasn't sufficient state oversight over the Minneapolis Employee Retirement Fund to, that put us in this situation, plus, a century ago, bad decisions that were saddled with. So now I understand why Minneapolis is special because of the lack of appropriate state oversight and historic bad decisions.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I remember this because I was sitting on the Pension Commission when we decided some of these laws. And Representative Lang, I think that the statute specifies a dollar amount, not a percentage. So in the graph here, and to either the author of the bill or to Mr. Rice, in the graph, it basically looks like the city has had a hiatus from the responsibility that was theirs prior to 2016. So I'm wondering what the city did with those savings. If they can answer that, maybe more rhetorical. But so would the benefits offered through MRF change based upon the fluctuation that you're suggesting in the funding?
Mr. Chairman, thank you, Mr. Chairman, Representative Albright. Benefits did not change. What happened is that there was a second actuarial evaluation, and the numbers were dropped to $37 million, rather from the cost of $55 million. The contribution for the cities right after that actual rail evaluation remained at 31, then it did drop down to 21. I can't tell you exactly what the city did, but I do know we've set up a pension fund to be able to pay for debt service and pension costs in the future. So some of that money probably went into our fund to cover pension costs and other costs.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So regardless of what we do with the funding, the pension monthly payment benefits to the participants will not change.
That is my understanding, Mr. Absolutely. Chairman, and that, and I think the number of people in the fund is decreasing.
And Mr. Ranieri, when the funds merged in, were the COLAs cut, so therefore future payments to the it did affect the benefits the employee the retirees were received because the COLAs were cut, if I remember right.
Mr. Chairman, when this was done, we used the term shared responsibility, and the employees themselves also took a reduction. I think their COLAs were cut and frozen.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rice, good morning.
Good morning.
Love the tie.
I was looking for yours this morning, sir.
You know, I'm just waiting for some assistance in a tutorial on that. Mr. Rice, and I'm not trying to put you on the spot here, but you referenced some bad decisions that were made locally. Mm-hmm. And I'm certainly not here to relitigate the pension deliberations about why Governor Dayton at the time did decide to sign this new agreement into law. But I think it would be cathartic for the benefit of the State Government Finance Commission if we could just, you know, walk back in terms of why the need for the state to step in and assist with MRF, if you're willing to expound on that.
I could try.
Mr. Rice.
Mr. Chair, the legislature has dealt with this MRF issue for over 100 years. It authorized the creation of MRF in 1919. And a friend of mine, Carl Croning, is a senator for a long time, had a saying, we did the best we could with what we knew at the time. So the legislature set up the plan in 1919. It went forward. Then people didn't live as long. You know, they'd retire at 60 or 65, and maybe they'd live to 70, and pensions didn't last that long. Well, time evolves. It goes on. By the time the 1970s came, Minneapolis, and not just Minneapolis, but when we say Minneapolis, it's really the system that was the pension plan for everybody who was doing government work on sewers, on airports, on hospitals, and the workhouse in the city, on road programs. By the state and the city just did not set aside the amount of contributions they needed to fund these pension plans. And it wasn't just in Minnesota, it was around the country. Starting in the 60s, The legislature, it might have been the late 50s, it actually was one of the first states to set up a legislative commission on pensions and retirement because they saw these as being big issues that needed to be managed. And the pension commission started to step in, do the research, require actuarial evaluations. And by the mid-70s, there was a pretty severe funding crisis. MRF may have been only, 30% funded. Arne Carlson was one of, the Governor Carlson was a Minneapolis City Council member and then a Minneapolis legislator, a state auditor. He was one of the leading voices that said, we have to address these problems. We have these massive unfunded liabilities. How are we going to deal with them? In the 70s, the legislature said, here's how we'll deal with it. We'll close the plan. We'll set up a 30-year funding schedule to 2010 to pay off these unfunded liabilities. We'll put the new employees in para. And we'll make a deal. And at that time, the deal was actually the state was paying about 60 or 70% of the cost. And it was about at least a 60-40 split where the state was paying most of this cost to get this fund fully funded. So Representative Vogel here, he's a banker. We all understand a 30-year mortgage. The idea was we'll do the numbers and we'll pay this off in 30 years. Sounds like a plan, right? It worked out for about a decade or so because the markets were growing, the contributions were coming in, things looked good. A lot of stuff happened on the way then. In the 90s, all of these plans were doing pretty good. The market was going up. The numbers looked like they were holding up actuarially. Then the dot-com bubble hit in 2001. The market dropped. We then started finding out that people were living longer than was assumed. Things got a little better, and the Great Recession hit. And that was, we didn't make it to 2010 in full funding. Along the way, the funding date got pushed out to 2020 because we weren't making the payments, or we weren't that. The target date got bumped back 10 years. I think that happened in the mid-90s. 2010 came along. What had happened then, where I think there was a, this was a bad state decision, a bad local decision. They used to have a thing called the post fund, which you heard about on the pension commission, where once somebody retired, we transfer all the assets to a post fund. That would be the retiree's benefit. And then as the post fund grew, we promised any excess return, and we would raise benefits permanently to people. And, that seemed to work for a long time in the 90s. Some years there were double-digit increases, both at state level.
Can we come to a conclusion?
Sure. In MRF.
We could talk for 2 hours.
I could have started with the Peloponnesian War, but I thought that might be too far back in history. So it looked good, but then the model was wrong. The state had to deal with this, too. There were 3 years of double-digit pension increases. Craziness. But those were committed. Then the Great Recession hits. We had to, that's when the consolidation happened, and that's when the split was done, Gene. It was the state was putting in.
I walked through it.
Yeah, okay. That history, the numbers were put in, they were really significant, $55 million and, huge amounts of money. Then it got better, but then there was this merger, and so now we're dealing with a $37 million a year amount of payment that needs to go to PARA to make the retirees whole. The original split was going to be $21 million from the city and $16 million from the state. That deal lasted for, was put in statute in 2015. Then it was changed to 31 and 6, and the 37 has to get paid to PARA. So that nobody's benefits are impacted. And the question I'd say to the committee, what's the fair split? Right now it's 5-1 local to state. When they did the Duluth teacher consolidation or the Minneapolis teacher or the local police and fire consolidations, it was more like a 60-40 split. And, is it fair or not? I think the bill that Representative Long has makes that arrangement more balanced between the state and the local entities.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Understood. It's just, when you spend 25 years in the business and you have Mr. Rice in front of you, you tend to hark back to old times.
especially when you have such a distinguished looking beard.
Mr. Rice, I'll give you 20 minutes to stop talking about me like that. Mr. Rice, just a follow-up, and it's quickly, and you can answer or nod. Was this vetted by the Pension Commission?
Mr. Rice?
Yes. Tuesday night.
And from Representative Long's testimony from that as well, was it unanimous or was there dissent?
Mr. Chairman, it sounded like there was no dissent. It was a voice vote.
It was a voice vote. I think Representative Vogel and I are both on the commission, and I don't believe there was any dissenters.
It wasn't the most enthusiastic voice vote, but there was no dissent.
And so, Representative Long or to Mr. Rice, is this going to complete the task for this problem? Or are we going to have issues with this? I mean, there continues to be, and this is my op-ed, there continues to be this problematic presumption that we don't rely upon the assumed rate of return, that we always look to the market rate performance for making up for the contributions that should be made to it. And to some extent, I'm singing harmony to the need for more money. But we have to rely upon the actuarial report, not the market returns, to fund these programs. We are fiduciaries to the people that have been promised these benefits. And if we keep tinkering around with either promise of greater benefits or relying upon the market to heal the self-inflicted wounds, if you will, that we continue to fillet ourselves with, we are never going to work ourselves out of this problem with our pensions. And so in as much as that I chafe at, you know, the change that we work really, really hard at to complete, I hope that this solves and is a valuable lesson for us all to recognize how important it is to look at the long term and the actuarial presumptions that we put into statute as opposed to the markets, which are fickle, and we cannot rely upon them. So, Mr. Rice, I look forward to talking with you further about bow ties.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as we sat through this the other night, can attest to the discussion that we had, and not everybody was enthused is probably a nice way to put it. First of all, just a couple of observations, because this is going to go through the process, and I don't know how it ends up, but observation is that, first of all, we should not be looking back to this percentage thing. There's nothing to substantiate that there was a percentage split done in 2010 or 2015. There was a dollar amount split. And as I understand it from the conversations the other night, yes, you can extrapolate percentages from those amounts, but the original settlement was on an amount, and I'd just like to clarify that again. I see some shaking of heads there that maybe not.
Hey, Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, no, that's correct. I didn't mean to imply otherwise. Okay. I just thought it was helpful for the committee to understand roughly what the percentages were. But, yes, the statute specified a dollar amount in 2015, and that dollar amount was supposed to be ongoing until 2031. That was changed, and so we're trying to reestablish the agreed-upon dollar amount from 2015.
Representative Vogel.
So thank you. So, Mr. Chair, as we go forward, using the percentage thing as justification or rationale, I don't see as being the right way to look at this. It's a dollar split. And the other part of that is this is a dollar split of politics of how much is everybody else going to pay for Minneapolis's pension plan, because I understand what all the history and everything, but quite honestly, I don't think that my taxpayers in Elko, Newmarket, or New Prague, or Belle Plaine, or Lee Sterling Center are really going to, other than they do get some subsidy from the state for PERA, possibly, but nothing to the extent relative to the population and the split that's being done here. So I think as this thing goes forward, we should keep the debate to basically how much are we going to subsidize Minneapolis, because that's really the question that needs to be answered. Thank you.
Well, with that, members, I'm going to lay this over for possible inclusion. And next bill we have is Representative Schultz. Do I see her? Oh, there she is. And I'll move House File 1855 to be referred back to the Ways and Means Committee. welcome to the committee, and and hopefully we can get through this. Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 1855 is a bill that has a constitutional amendment to create an independent redistricting commission and put a question on the ballot. And the question would be, shall the Minnesota Constitution be amended to transfer from the legislature to an independent redistricting commission the power to draw congressional and legislative districts? This bill will give the voters a chance to weigh in on whether they want legislators to continue drawing district maps. Redistricting or drawing political boundaries occurs every 10 years after a census. Currently, legislators in Minnesota draw the maps, or they attempt to draw the maps. Since the 1970s, the courts have had to draw maps because there's been no bipartisan agreement, except for once when one governor forgot to do a veto of the map. Minnesota needs to follow the lead of other states and create an independent commission to create legislative congressional districts. The risk of having one political party draw maps is too great. We only have to look to Wisconsin, where gerrymandered districts have led to a disproportionate number of one party being elected to their assembly that doesn't reflect the popular vote. And just this week, on Tuesday, the U.S. Supreme Court heard cases on political gerrymandering, so we're just waiting for the decisions of those justices now. Nationally, about 120 of 435 House seats were considered competitive in the 1970s. Today, only about 20 are considered competitive, and this has led to polarization and gridlock in D.C., and we don't want this to happen to Minnesota. We need bipartisan solutions to help address all of the issues we face as a state. Having an independent commission, I think, will also restore the trust in government. People need to have confidence that their vote counts, that it matters. So I believe the legislature should just continue drawing political maps and not have to take a risk if one party controls the legislature and the governor's office. And with that, I'll stand for questions. And I do have a testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Do you need to have testimony, or are you there to answer questions? And please identify yourself for the tape.
Mr. Chairman, good morning, members of the committee. My name is Peter Watson. That's W-A-T-T-S-O-N. I billed myself as a retired Minnesota Senate counsel. I started drafting legal descriptions for a legislative redistricting plan in 1971. I didn't become counsel for the Rules Committee until 1973, and I didn't become counsel for the Finance Committee until 1975.
Can you speak into the mic, please?
Yes. Thank you. And I only had 2 years as Secretary of the Senate. That was 2009 and 2010. But I'm here to support Representative Schultz, who back in October asked for my assistance in drawing a bill to address the problem that she has identified. And the problem she's identified is one that the members of the committee are very familiar with, but I think most voters in this state are not. And the reason why they're not familiar with the problem, which is that the legislature over the years has failed to carry out its constitutional responsibility to redraw congressional and legislative district boundaries at its first session following a census, they're not aware because we've got such an efficient system for dealing with that problem. The legislature passed a pair of congressional and legislative plans in 2011. Was there any great concern about that in the public? I don't think so. When the legislature's two plans were promptly vetoed by Governor Dayton, at that time I was serving as his general counsel, I assisted with the treatment of those bills, did that register even a ripple in the waters of public opinion in this state? No, because that's what always happens. And what happened after that? The members of this committee are familiar with, but most members of the public, most voters, I think, are not. And that is that the Minnesota Supreme Court went ahead and appointed a panel of five judges, some district judges, some Court of Appeals judges, to draw plans in the face of the failure of the legislature to carry out its constitutional responsibility. I think everybody here knows the legislature has been having the courts draw plans since the 1970s. That was my first court lawsuit when the Minnesota Senate intervened in a lawsuit that had resulted in a reduction in the number of senators from 67 to 35, which the Senate thought was not right, and got the Supreme Court to agree it was not right. And that's why the legislative plan of 1972 wasn't adopted by the court until June. Nobody wants that. But what many people outside this committee are not aware of is that this was not unusual for there to have been a failure in 72, or a failure in 82 and 92 and 2002 and 2012. This is not unusual. The last time, some of you know, the Minnesota legislature fulfilled that constitutional responsibility to adopt a legislative plan in the first session after a census, without court assistance, was 1881. Now, 130 years of failure, I think, is enough to establish the need to do something differently. And that's why Representative Schultz had asked me to assist her with the drafting of the bill. And I am pleased to answer any questions that you might have about it, and in particular, the fiscal note, which I think we've all been looking for. It. Maybe we don't have, but I do see that Mr. Hubinger from the LCC is in the audience, and representatives of the Secretary of State's office are in the audience who could give some idea of the impact. I think it is not particularly large. 10 years ago, the fiscal note was $141,000. So I don't know what it is this time, but it's not a big deal.
Ms. Roberts, I think we have a number of...
Mr. Chair, members, I apologize. I requested the fiscal note on the incorrect version of the bill. I did not realize that an amendment that had been adopted earlier in elections had later been taken off the bill. The standard fiscal note for a constitutional amendment to the state is $2,000 for the Secretary of State, and they've always absorbed that cost. We saw a similar fiscal note earlier this year on the Equal Rights Amendment. That's because most of the costs for passing a constitutional amendment are local government costs. The LCC did do quite a bit of work on the wrong version, again, my fault, and in fact stayed here late last night to do that. And I can say that if the constitutional amendment passed, there would be costs to the LCC of approximately, I think it's 50, let's see if I can get to the right page, $57,000 in the first year, and then some additional costs in the second year, and then there would be some very small costs for the Secretary of State involved with the establishment of the commission. But we don't consider those costs in a fiscal note for a constitutional amendment because they're secondary and would only occur if the amendment actually passed.
So members, I've got questions. Representative Quam, you're on the list, and if we can be kind to Representative Schultz, she's not a little under the weather. I think she's got the croup that's been going around here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard repetition of the use of the word failure. And, you know, frankly, a lot of the discussion is national and all this stuff national. If I look at Minnesota and whatever our current system is, false, positive things, etc., we had half of our congressional districts change party in the middle. You know, the redistricting was done years ago, half. And to me, that means Minnesota was competitive, and that what we're doing wasn't a failure, and by definition is giving us competitive districts. The examples I hear come from national and other locations, not within Minnesota. the purview of choosing, you know, the districting is Minnesota, and we should look at what works for us. And no matter what faults or complaints or how messy the system appears to be, frankly, I think our system has done us well. I hear the author is fearful that we might have one party control both chambers and the executive branch. Well, we had that within my period of time serving on here, and I think I would probably be more fearful of that time than the author. But you know, frankly, are we being hyperbolic about things nationally? I know there's a lot of gerrymandering of districts in California, which already has a similar citizen, etc., commission, and not the legislature. So there's no guarantee that if we take this proposal, but if I look at this, how does this bill stand on its own? At least the copy that was in my packet didn't appear to have the system at which the supermajority of the members would be selected and chosen. And frankly, that's disconcerting because a bill should be able to be complete and stand on its own. And it's flawed to say, well, we've got these other bills that might pass. Frankly, a lot of people let us know we got bills back this year that were part of a supplemental omnibus bill and et cetera that were vetoed. That a lot of us thought, well, gee, it passed with a fairly good support. It would become law. So we should not be moving forward a bill that is not capable of standing on its own because it's missing a process, little teeny thing, that has the vast majority, a supermajority of the entity we're trying to support creating, undefined. That, if I was to vote for, would be malfeasance. So I've got a couple areas of which I have difficulty with this bill. Thank you.
That was more of a statement than a question I see there.
Mr. Chair, I think part of our duty here is to have a conversation and let the author and the other members know about aspects of the bill. And if we are going to restrict allowing statements by members or criticizing and trying to impede that.
Representative Palm, I did not shut you down. I just said that sounded more like a statement than a question. I didn't hear a question there. Representative Claiborne, you have a question.
I do have a question. And as we are looking at this bill, I just want to make sure that the purpose of our committee, we are not here to scrutinize the bill line by line. That was done in other committees. Are we not here to speak to the fiscal note and the cost for state government? I'm just trying to get some guidance and clarity on.
Representative Claiborne, we do. It is we are the finance committee, and we should be looking at the finance piece of it. But the other portions of the bill, we also are open to discussion here because they deal with how this is going to be financed. So I believe some of the discussion we're having is appropriate, but we are here to discuss the finances of it, and that gets moved down to Ways and Means, and then Ways and Means will send it where it needs to go. Normally a constitutional amendment has to go to rules before it can go to the floor. And in past years, with to answer some of what Representative Quam's question is about the mechanics of this, if this passes, it'd be on the ballot next time. It probably isn't enough time to set up this commission for the next redistricting because that'll be right at the time we should be around the time we should be doing this. But we'll have to pass legislation to set up that commission, and that can be done in a separate vote or a separate bill.
All right, then my question would be then to Ms. Roberts. Are you anticipating, so you have given us this number of $57,000 roughly. And I'm just wondering if you think it would be significantly more than that, or if that truly would be the cost.
Mr. Chair and members, I misspoke. I was looking at the wrong table on the fiscal note, which was on the wrong version. Again, the cost for simply putting a question on the ballot is about $2,000, which will be absorbed. If this, if the amendment was passed, the estimated cost that the LCC was looking at for the commission would be $155,000 in the first year and then $47,000 in the second year.
Okay.
But we wouldn't track those costs anywhere because those are considered secondary and would only occur if the amendment passed.
It just seemed to me the number that we originally heard was low, so I just wanted to make sure I truly understood the impact.
I misspoke. I'm sorry.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I was just looking at the language in the state constitution. It says in Article 4, Section 3, that the legislature shall have the power to prescribe the bounds of congressional and legislative districts. Given what Mr. Watson said, I mean, it's hard to characterize what the legislature's done the last several redistricting cycles as anything besides a failure, because we've left it to a panel of judges. We haven't, you know, I'm very glad to see this bill. I think it's something that's much needed. We haven't. Because it's been left to a panel of judges, I don't think we have had much gerrymandering. There have been fairly competitive districts, but we easily could. And frankly, we easily could on the DFL side of things. In the next, you know, we will have a DFL governor that will oversee the next redistricting cycle. It's the House is currently DFL controlled. It's possible it could stay that way, and it's possible in the 2020. Election, the Senate could flip, and gerrymandering can go both ways. The example of Wisconsin was given. That's primarily a Republican. You know, the accusations have been that the gerrymandering was caused by the Republicans there. The state of Maryland, there have been accusations that state is gerrymandered as well, and that's been a Democratic controlled process there. So, you know, I think. This is a needed good government reform. I'm glad Representative Schultz have brought it forward. Constitutional amendments are often passed, and the details are left to the legislature to fill it in. So this wouldn't be anything new. So I'm certainly supportive of this bill, and I'm glad to see it here.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz, I just want to spend a couple minutes looking at the bill itself and some of the specifics in here. Let me start by talking about, and certainly respectful of what Chair Freiberg and Chair Nelson have said about the enabling language that isn't in this bill, that would actually be the responsibility of the LC, the legislature, as well as other governing bodies. But you know, we don't make decisions about law in a vacuum, and we're certainly, from my impression, making a decision here based upon a glass half full. We're making a decision based upon enabling a group of people to make decisions about what's in the best interests of the state without really knowing, as an example, on page 1. On line 1.21, where it says a public member must be eligible. So how are they appointed, and where do they come from? Just as a start, Mr. Chair.
Representative Schultz.
Well, you can look at House File 1605, or you can look at when this bill was divided at the enabling legislation for details. Or the legislature can decide to come up with different enabling legislation to see how a bipartisan agreement we can get to fill those slots.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schultz, you've just given me four different options to choose from. That's not how we make legislation. We make legislation based upon what is in a bill. And if it doesn't stand on its own merits, you can't enact language based upon what's in other pieces of law or of other suggested legislative intent. It doesn't work that way. Representative Schultz, on page 3, lines 3.15 through 3.20, could you explain how that section of the bill works?
Representative Schultz, maybe Mr. Watson.
Could you please repeat the lines?
3.15 to 3.20 is what I heard.
Correct, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, that's the proportionality guideline. So these are the principles, guidelines that we should be that should be used when drawing the maps.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, you just explained that in subjective terms that do not give, as if I were a member of the commission, any clarity in terms of how I would go about objectively looking at redistricting or putting a map together. Representative Schultz, could you explain lines 3.23 through 3.25?
Representative Schultz.
What are those principles, Representative Schultz?
You want me to read through the whole bill?
I'd just like, for clarity, if the whole bill is a principle, Mr. Chair, that's a subjective term. This is a subjective want versus a need. I will close my comments with a couple things. You know, and I think I share Representative Quam's observations. You know, oftentimes we criticize criticize the process that's in statute. And let's just for a second take a look at the process of redistricting. It's murky. From a standpoint of you don't know what's going to happen, but in every case, the legislature has done its job and moved forward a map that was felt to be appropriate based upon the demographics and the census data. And in every case, the executive branch has decided that they wanted to do it differently, not the legislature. Representative Schultz, you are bringing forth a bill to state government finance that doesn't have a fiscal note. With respect to Ms. Roberts, we don't know the full details of a fiscal note on this bill. We have assumptions, but they are incumbent upon us knowing in order to put a bill together next week for state government finance that will affect our target. You have no enabling language in this. You've given me four different observations in terms of how I might interpret this based upon four other bills that are working through the process right now. That's not good legislation. Mr. Chair, a question for you in terms of recommendation after the re-referral back to Ways and Means. Is there a recommendation that we are giving to Ways and Means?
Mr. Representative Albright, no. As I stated in my other remarks, constitutional amendments have to go to rules. Just because that's part of our process. I believe it's in our rules. So that's probably where it's going to end up. But we're sending it to the Uber chair, and the Uber chair of the Ways and Means Committee will decide if it's got to go elsewhere.
Mr. Chair, I would make a motion to amend your re-referral with the recommendation that it be re-referred to elections. And I would request a roll call.
It's already at elections.
Well, a roll call has been requested. There's an amendment. Representative Schultz.
So this bill has already been heard in elections.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
And Representative Schultz. And first, I want to clarify my motion that it would go to GovOps rather than elections, because elections actually is subordinate to GovOps. And to the assertion by the author of the bill that it's already been seen there, Mr. Chair, I don't think that this is ready for prime time. And I think that it would be incumbent upon the Government Operations Committee, and the chair is in our midst today, that he reconsider the provisions of this bill and think long and hard about some of the observations made by the members of this committee.
With that, members, there's a motion has been made to amend the motion to send this bill to Ways and Means.
Chair Nelson, may I speak to that before you take a vote?
Just let's vote. We can get this off. We need to get moving along on this.
Okay.
The clerk will take the roll.
On the motion to refer to Ways and Means with a recommendation to Government Ops?
Correct.
Amend the motion. Chair Nelson?
No.
Vice Chair Carlson?
No.
Representative Albright?
Yes.
Representative Acomb?
No.
Representative Elkins?
No.
Representative Freiberg?
No.
Representative Green?
Yes.
Representative Hertas?
Yes.
Representative Hewitt?
No.
Representative Keel?
Yes.
Representative Cleborne?
No.
Representative Lippert?
No.
Representative Long?
No.
Representative Mason?
No.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Quam?
C.
Representative Vogel?
Yes.
It being 11 nays and 6 ayes, the motion fails.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Make a motion to table the bill. And I will request a roll call.
Motion's been made to table the bill. Roll call being asked for. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Nelson.
No.
Vice Chair Carlson?
No.
Representative Albright?
Yes.
Representative Acomb?
No.
Representative Elkins?
No.
Representative Freiberg?
No.
Representative Green?
Yes.
Representative Hertas?
Yes.
Representative Hewitt?
No.
Representative Keel?
Yes.
Representative Cleborne?
No.
Representative Lippert?
No.
Representative Long?
No.
Representative Mason?
No.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Quam?
Aye.
Representative Vogel?
Yes.
There being 6 ayes and 11 nays, the motion fails.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Request a roll call on re-referral of the motion that you made.
Okay, there's a roll call has been requested. I got two more people on the list here. We got two more bills we have to do. Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a couple of comments. First of all, I think Mr. Wesson made a very compelling argument for the bill. And I know Representative Schultz has worked a long time on this bill. But I did find Representative Quam's perspective interesting as well. The comment I want to make is, whatever you feel about the bill, we will be giving up our legislative authority, and my guess it will be forever. And to me, that is a big deal. So it's something to think about because we're going to have to live with that decision forever. And somewhere along the line, somebody thought the legislature did have the ability to do this.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the question I had has been already asked and answered, but the comment is the same as Representative Mason. This is, you know, the legislature has done its job. The executive branch didn't agree, and that's why this was put into the court. That is our system. But to advocate our authority is wrong, and we do it a lot around here. If things don't go the way we want, well, let's take the authority away from the legislature. This is our job, guys. This is one of the reasons why we're here.
and to say we don't like the way the system is working, so let's put it in the hands of someone else. There's no guarantee that if this goes into the hands of the commission, these still aren't going to end up in court. Do you think that because a panel has been appointed, that no one is going to be disagreeing with that panel? This is not going to solve our problem, but it is going to damage the authority of the legislature. I do not like this bill. I hope that it does not move.
Seeing no further questions, a roll call being requested. I'll renew my motion that House File 1855 be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All those, the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Nelson.
Yes.
Vice Chair Carlson.
Yes.
Representative Albright.
No.
Representative Acomb.
Yes.
Representative Elkins.
Yes.
Representative Freiberg.
Yes.
Representative Green.
No.
Representative Hertas.
No.
Representative Hewitt.
Yes.
Representative Keel.
No.
Representative Cleavorn.
Yes.
Representative Lippert.
Yes.
Representative Long.
Yes.
Representative Mason.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Guam.
Nay.
Representative Vogel.
No.
The vote being 11 ayes and 6 nays, the motion passes. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. Thank you, members.
The next bill we have is House File 2057, Representative Moran. Welcome to the committee, and explain your bill. And I'll move House File 2057 for possible inclusion, to be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and good morning, everyone. So House File 2057 resurrects a change brought forward by the North Central Minority Supplier Development Council, known as, for the purpose of this, NCMSDC. It's a private industry group supporting suppliers' diversity that came forth during the 2016 session. The proposed change will allow the Department of Administration to accept certifications by nationally recognized certified bodies to verify that a business is eligible for the targeted group business program. In 2016, the proposal was included in the Omnibus Supplemental Budget Bill, but did not make it through the conference committee process. In 2018, this language was included in the department's policy bill, but did not receive a hearing in either body despite repeated requests. At present, the certifying criteria and processes used by many private industry certifying groups, such as NCMSDC, are substantially similar to those of the state, with the exception that private certifiers charge a fee, have no cap on the size of business, and do not verify whether the business is based in Minnesota, all of which are requirements to receive a targeted group preference under Minnesota law. The proposed change will streamline the process by becoming a targeted group business. Minority women, persons with disabilities, and veteran-owned businesses. For those businesses, they are already certified by a private entity by allowing the business to forego portions of the state certifying process. This change will allow admin to increase the number of certified businesses in the targeted group business program and will likely result in increased spending with diverse businesses. The proposal is an initiative by the department to improve the program and allow greater participation in state contracting by minorities, women, and veteran businesses. I have the Department of Administration Commissioner Alice Roberts Davis here with me today to answer any questions members may have. Thank you all.
And Mr. Roberts Davis, do you need to speak or testify, or just there to answer questions?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. If I could just have a moment to add on to what Representative Moreno said.
Please identify yourself for the tape, then.
I'm Alice Roberts Davis, Commissioner for the Department of Administration. In 2015, the Department of Administration established the Office of Equity and Procurement, and since that time, we have really seen some great improvement in spend with disadvantaged businesses. The spend that we track is only for certified businesses, and that's why this bill is very important. A couple of the programs that we put into place since 2015 include a program called Equity Select, which means that any business that is certified as a targeted group business can be directly selected up to $25,000. And what that does is it allows the buyers to not go through the full process for procurement, which is very attractive to them. It's also used as a marketing tool for businesses so that they can meet with procurement professionals and win those awards more easily. Another program that we put in place is called Sheltered Markets, and as long as we have at least three targeted group businesses that are competing, we can allow just targeted group businesses to compete for a particular contract, which means that, in effect, we will ensure that the business is going to a targeted group business. The final thing, or one of the other things that we've also implemented, is a program called Prompter Pay. We always pay our vendors prompt. But if you're a targeted group business, then you're paid within 15 days, which really does solve some of their cash flow problems that we've heard because access to capital for small businesses is an issue. So there are a lot of benefits that come along with certification for these small disadvantaged businesses. The problem that we run into often is that we don't have enough certified businesses in the pool. We'd like to be able to use the Sheltered Markets program more regularly. There just aren't enough businesses that are qualified to do that because of the certification. The certification process is rigorous, and we think that it should be because there is a lot of benefit that comes along with being a targeted group certified business. But when we're talking about small business owners, if they have the opportunity to spend time selling widgets or filling out paperwork, they would much rather sell widgets, and often the certification process that they go through is through many different entities. They go through it with private companies. They go through it with state, local, federal, so it becomes quite burdensome for them. There are, however, some national certifying bodies who can do that work for us, and the businesses find that really attractive because, number one, they become certified nationally, and then, number two, that also is the certification that most corporations are looking for, so it really gives them a much broader reach with the certification that they are pursuing. If we were able to accept these national certifications, it would allow us to get more businesses into our certified pool. It would increase the reach of our program, and it would allow us to direct more contracts to these disadvantaged businesses. Of course, to Representative Moran's point, we would be overlaying our criteria onto their criteria, so we would ensure that they are principally based in Minnesota and that they do meet the federal size requirements that require that they are a small business. So that's what the proposal would, how it would assist the Department of Administration.
Thank you. Questions? I have Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As someone that works in public sector procurement, I'm really excited about this bill. The Equity Select program, I'm glad to see that there's an emphasis on expanding that. The prompter pay, I'm glad you brought that up. With small businesses, cash is king. And as government, we know we like to hold on to our money as long as possible. But by processing invoices within 15 days to get that money for the work that has been completed to those vendors, is it vendors now, suppliers, contractors? What?
All of the above.
All the above. Right.
You know, that seems like Robert Davis.
Mm-hmm. The term is always changing. So this is, I think, a much-needed modernization of the procurement process for the state. I love the idea that this will indeed expand the amount of businesses within the pool to allow for smaller utilized businesses to take advantage of these smaller state contracts. So thank you for bringing this forward. I'm very much in favor of it.
Thank you.
Representative Vogel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, to which testifier, but nationally recognized seems a little bit subjective. I'm curious, what are the criteria, or how are you looking at the fiscal note and saying that that you don't anticipate any extra work that wouldn't be able to be handled by staff? What is a nationally recognized certifying? Is it, or how are you determining that?
Ms. Roberts Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, there are two organizations, three potentially that are nationally recognized. One of them is the National Minority Supplier Development Council. The other is the Women's Business Economic National Council. And those two organizations are just very well known. They are the two table stakes for women-owned businesses and for minority-owned businesses. And so when I say nationally recognized, I mean that if you go into the community, those are the two organizations that people are asking for, corporations are asking for certifications from.
Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, but what if I wanted to start a new nationally recognized certification program? Wouldn't you then have to do some research to make sure that it's bona fide?
Ms. Roberts-Davis.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vogel, I think the national recognition comes from the fact that these are established organizations and that corporations are seeking their certifications. And so I don't think that you can start a nationally recognized organization. I think that that would have to grow, and then that reputation would have to precede becoming a national organization. The other thing that I would also add to that is that their requirements for certification are nearly identical to the requirements that we have at the state of Minnesota. And so I would say that as long as your requirements for certification are nearly identical, then we would look at your requirements and say potentially you could be a nationally recognized organization that we would accept.
Representative Vogel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I know you're trying to move this along, so I'm not going to belabor it. But I look at this fiscal note saying that, well, we can handle this. Now, you're looking at two organizations that you feel are acceptable to you as the department, but may not be, there may be a lot of others. So as I look at the fiscal note and no fiscal impact, that may be true, but it may not be true. And I sometimes I look at these, and they're so subjective in the way they're done, because I do think that somebody could come along and say, I want to be a certification agency, even though there are two that people like now. So, again, I won't belabor it, but I do think that as we look at these things, it's one thing for a department to say we don't think it's going to cause any more work because they need to get a fiscal note done, but I'm not so certain when you get into things like this and you look at other organizations that might come along that it might not take a lot of time and research to be able to say that they're viable to be doing this. So, again, no question, because I know you want to move it along. But
I just want to say, Mr. Chair, that, you know, we've been moving a lot of bills through this body, and it's not often that we come across a state entity that says, I'm not going to have an impact. It's not going to be a fiscal note. So when I hear a state entity says that we can handle this work, it's not going to be, you know, it's not extra work, it's not going to have a fiscal impact, I want to be able to say that's a good thing. That is a good thing because we know that everything costs money. But here we have a department said that this is something that we're willing to take part on and actively seeking to really create a process where we can have more businesses in this procurement process.
And Commissioner, if a new group came forward, a new certifying group came forward, I believe you would be vetting them to make sure if they did meet your standards. And would they be added to the list of groups that certify businesses?
Mr. Chair, I would say that if we vetted them and that they did meet or they had very similar requirements to the state of Minnesota, then potentially we would accept their certification. There's nothing that would require us to accept their certification. What we're asking for is permission for the commissioner to accept those certifications if it makes sense within the work that we're doing. I would also say that there are people within the department who are doing this type of certification work right now. It is a very labor-intensive process, and this would really be helpful to them because it would allow us to have someone else for no charge do a lot of that legwork for them, and then they could go on to doing the counseling and the working directly with the businesses and showing them how to get those opportunities with the state, which is really where the financial benefit comes to those small businesses.
Thank you. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question for Department of Admin or for the author of the bill. So, you know, time was that we looked to Deed or Dolly or the Small Administration for support of small businesses, minority or otherwise. And I don't know if we've just become siloed, but the question is, this seems eerily similar to programs that I've heard about in jobs and other economic development committee meetings. And I'm just wondering, isn't this same type of a certification or assistance with work towards getting state-sponsored contracts already available to small employers through Deed Dolly or the SBA. So are we duplicating, or is it more of a in a sense, evidence of weakness that those programs are not being made aware of and provided to small businesses? So I'm just wondering if we're going after another bright, shiny object that isn't already provided by one of our state agencies. So would welcome your comments.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, the Targeted Group Business Program has been with the Department of Administration for about 40 years. The work that we do is not duplicative with Deed because we're working with business owners to help them obtain state contracts specifically. We're not helping them do business development in general within the community. And so this work is really specific to helping them earn state contracts.
Seeing no further questions, I'll renew my motion that, and we'll lay this over for possible inclusion. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you.
And the last bill on the day is House File 2144. Representative Crecia. Welcome to the committee. And
thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I'll move House File 2144 for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 2144 is a bill that asks for a $400,000 appropriation for two important pieces of Minnesota history. One of them, and with me, by the way, is Randall Dietrich, who's the director of the Military Museum in Camp Ripley, who I'll introduce and give comments to in a minute. But what we're trying to do here is preserve two very important parts of Minnesota's history. One of them is General Vesey Jr., who, if you're familiar with General Vesey, he enlisted in 1939, spent 46 years in the military. One of those tours was in World War II in Europe, and the other one was the Joint Chief of Staff Chairman under President Reagan, and very important during the Cold War era. And with him, he's donated many artifacts to the collection, memories, and things that are very important to preserve and something that we should make sure that we keep sharing. The other side that you'll hear from Executive Director Dietrich is the 9/11. Minnesota's participation in 9/11, the memories of that, and trying to put a collection together so that we can keep that alive as well and not forget about that. Long before being appointed executive director for the Military Museum, Mr. Dietrich developed the Greatest Generation Project. He chaired by General John Vesey for the Minnesota Historical Society. He coordinated the work of the Minnesota Civil Assessment. 150, I'm going to change that word. The Minnesota Civil 150-year task force chaired by Dean Erdahl and Mark Ritchie and himself served on the state World War I Centennial Committee. In addition, Randall's produced documentary programs for Minnesota Public Radio and the Twin Cities Public Television. He knows these issues and he knows them well. And what we're trying to do is get the appropriate appropriation so that we can continue to talk about these assets and collections. And with that, I'll turn it over to my testifier.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you. My name is Randall Dietrich, Executive Director of the Minnesota Military Museum at Camp Ripley. The Minnesota Military Museum recently became the principal repository of the extensive collection of General John Vesey, Minnesota's most decorated veteran. You have a handout identifying his career of service spanning 46 years. From uniforms to photographs to documents and personal correspondence, this is a unique set of items that require detailed cataloging and care by our archivist and curator. The collection that we came into possession with due to the donation of the general's daughter, Sarah Vesey, includes 30 cubic feet of records, 45 photo albums, 500 separate photographs, 484 three-dimensional objects, including the Presidential Medal of Freedom, 1,000 books from the general's personal library, and 40,000 sheets of paper and documents with officials from around the world during his 46-year tenure. General Vesey maintained a strong relationship with our museum. prior to his passing in 2016 and personally delivered many of these objects to our museum over the years. It's been our commitment and his now to make that collection available to the public. And to that end, we created a Vesey Collections Committee, which includes input from Sarah Vesey to make sure that we're properly getting this information out to people to learn from and study, as well as Rick Nash, former Adjutant General, Dr. Thomas Saylor, and our museum and curator. We've had interest from the National Defense University, the George C. Marshall Foundation, and certainly some of these collection items will appear in the new 34th Division infant headquarters being built in Arden Hills. Getting that work together and then sharing it with people statewide to study that legacy is an important part of what we're working on in the years ahead, and we ask for your support.
Questions?
As a footnote to that, if I could continue for a moment, General Vesey, like many of you, have stories from 9/11, and another major initiative that we're asking for support from is to look at that period of time. General Vesey was at the United Nations in New York City the morning of September 11, 2001, and in anticipation of the 20th anniversary of 9/11, the museum seeks to launch a sweeping statewide initiative to gather Minnesota stories from soldiers and civilians about what's become America's longest war. Minnesotans found themselves in the front line in 2001, and the resulting 20-year war has been increasingly fought by citizen soldiers of the reserves and National Guard. Thousands of Minnesota service men and women have been deployed, often placing tremendous strain on their families. The time to preserve these records and reflect on this era is now, for the benefit of the veterans, their families, the general public, and future generations. And in doing so, we're actually taking a page from history in that the state legislature, in the aftermath of the Civil War and in the aftermath of World War I, took on a similar initiative, and that's what's inspired this work to go forward. We're trying to gather these stories using 21st century tools and techniques to help preserve these stories for future generations. Minnesotans were on the front line in 2001, you know, in Flight 93, Tom Burnett was aboard. There was a Minnesotan killed in the Pentagon who was a Vietnam veteran the morning of September 11th. There were Minnesotans in the World Trade Center. We want to document and gather those stories. But what we're endeavoring to do is not just focus on that day. That's chapter one in this definitive history of this 20-year war that we've been involved in. So the Red Bull's remarkable service in 21 consecutive months being deployed, other individuals who've served with distinction, and then families who've just been impacted. A few key components to wrap up with is we want to conduct interviews in all 87 counties with folks. We want to create an online source where people could share their stories, add photographs and remembrances of that day and the 20 years that have followed. And we believe that will go a long ways to developing a traveling exhibit that will go around the state of Minnesota, potentially being housed in state armories where people can come and see these stories of 9/11 before it's too late and before this memory gets any more removed. The benefit years ago as a historian, at least, from the Civil War, the Vietnam, folks wrote letters back and forth, and we have those records in our museum. But obviously in this technological media age, this correspondence is now emails and text messages, and so gathering this information is all the more pertinent. I would just wrap up by saying we've received letters of support from the VA Commissioner Larry Herkey, Professor of History Annette Atkins, former Secretary of State Mark Ritchie, who is on our board, and also Senator Roger Reiner, former state senator who's now deployed in Kabul, Afghanistan. And just a final comment on that. His letter to us and to you is dated March 14th, from Kabul, Afghanistan. And he says, Governor Walz and members of the state legislature, I'm sending you this correspondence from Afghanistan where I have been deployed since last summer. It goes on for a number of paragraphs, but he closes with two final comments. Simply put, this story needs to be told. Global War on Terror veterans are invisible to many beyond their immediate family and friends. Their sacrifices deserve to be honored, and the Minnesota Military Museum are the right people to do it. I urge you to fully support this statewide initiative to gather stories from America's longest war. On behalf of the men and women whom I serve alongside, I thank you. Sincerely, Roger Reiner, Lieutenant Commander and former State Senator. Thank you.
Representative Crescia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll, before I take questions, the final comments that I just want to add to When you look at this appropriation, I hope you don't just look at this as one more budget item and we're doing something with a museum. Really what this is about the families, and it's about sharing those stories. And if you've had, and I'm sure many of you have, had somebody that's been in the service or affected by one of these events, it's one thing to pay attention and pay credence to that individual who served or maybe was deployed. But what I have found in walking through the military museum with my own family and other ones, it's also equally important to know the stories of what happened at home, to know how the families went through these events, because that's where the trauma comes in, that's where the suppression of emotion happens, that's when you get the families that aren't able to share, you know what, this is what it was like when grandma, grandpa, mom, dad, brother, sister, whoever, and this allows those family stories to be shared. I cannot tell you how many times I've been in the military museum walking through and reading the letters from the front lines and letters of the family and seeing people come through and go, yeah, that's what it was like. Yeah, that's what we went through. And then being able to turn to somebody and say, you know what, you went through that too. And suddenly we then take this away from this horrible event that people are afraid to talk about to a shared experience that is really a fabric of who we are.
Questions, members? Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Kreischer, for bringing this forward. I think this is
best bill you've heard today. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to put words in your mouth.
Representative Albright.
It's a fine piece of legislation, Representative Kreischer, and I hope that we can all fully support this as it moves through the process. Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, we'll lay this over for possible inclusion. And as a footnote for me, when you talk about 9/11 and the Pentagon, my brother was retired military and had crews of his that were working in the Pentagon the day that that happened, and he had to actually go because where their vehicle was inside the police corridor, whatever you want to call it. He actually had to come out and pick up his employees and drive them home. But thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. With that, members, we are adjourned.
Thank you.